Support for WPR comes from Monk Botanical Gardens in Wausau, hosting Blossom of Lights, an after-dark stroll through illuminated gardens, Wednesdays to Saturdays, mid-September through October. Blossomoflights.org.
Support for WPR comes from Lake Superior, Big Top Chautauqua, and Bayfield, presenting Elephant Revival with opening act two-runner on Friday, September 27th at 7. Tickets and info are at bigtop.org.
Great to have you with us on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Larry Mueller here. And you know what? It's Wednesday, the first Wednesday of the month, and that means a wildlife update with Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. We can talk about all kinds of things. We can talk about herps. We can talk about hunting. We can talk about loons. Lots to talk about with Scott, and I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we move along. Maybe you've got an experience to share or a question to ask. Number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Scott, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Always good to be here, Larry.
You know, about 3 hours ago, I got a news report from the DNR reminding us to be on the watch for frogs, salamanders, lizards, or snakes during the late summer and early fall. It's a time when they're out and moving across our roads, I guess.
It is. In addition to some animals that have metamorphosed from one life phase to another, like the tadpoles turning into frogs and the larval salamanders maturing, and especially with the dry conditions we've had, so a lot of the ponds are drying up. I mean, these animals are now moving off to get at least a little closer to where they're likely to spend the winter. So they're on the move for that reason, but they're also out on roads and paths and trails and open areas because we're getting some pretty cool mornings, and the weather's cooling down, and the sun heats up these open spaces, especially asphalt or concrete surfaces. And since these animals are, particularly the reptiles, not so much the amphibians, they try and stay away from dry, sunny conditions. But the snakes in particular will simply, oh, this is a nice spot, nice and warm, and curl up and sit there. And curling up and sitting on a busy roadway is not a good strategy if you're a snake. So I think the motivation for the DNR release was twofold, threefold probably. One, to create some awareness. Two, to encourage people to avoid interfering with or killing individuals if they can. And number three, I think there was a request in the news release also to report noteworthy observations of significant numbers of any of these species to the DNR so they can continue to build their database on the animals and do the best possible job of managing them.
Yeah, I think they're, you know, if you see a spot where there are a bunch of dead snakes or lizards or whatever on the road, they hope you can report with a photo to their amphibian mortality reporting form, and they say they can, if they find some spots they didn't know existed in terms of mass mortality areas, they can do something to sort of hopefully mitigate those areas, those locations.
Well, certainly that can be accomplished in part with signage, and there are also tactics like underpasses and so forth that will get at least some of the animals safely across the road.
Yeah. The Mercer Loon Festival was, I think, a couple of weeks ago, and it certainly brings to mind the status of loons in our state.
It does. It's, you know, for the Mercer area, it's a big deal, to say the least. They celebrate everything loon, and this particular celebration, I think, was back on August 12th, but in any event, it was the 44th annual Loon Day celebration, and I think anybody traveling up 51 has seen the giant loon statue known as Claire de Lune as you get into Mercer. So it becomes a big deal, and they celebrate everything loon and loon calling competitions and all sorts of things. But One of the things that attracted my attention was mention of a three-decade study of loons in northern Wisconsin. This was done by out-of-state academic folks. But it suggested that the adult loon population had declined by 22%. And there were also other categories for juvenile loons and so forth. But, the loons are so important to the whole ambiance and spirit of the North Woods that any hint of a decline is usually cause for concern, especially among local folks up there and other people concerned about loons. So there's something for northern lakefront property owners and whatnot to pay some attention to, and pay attention to those signs that say, hey, slow down here in your boats and stay away from nesting loons and so on. But this is, they'll be clearing out here before too long for the fall and winter, but there's plenty of time to think about it and get geared up to do what you can for loons come next spring when they get back.
Absolutely. Rick in Belleville has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Rick.
Hey, thanks, Larry. Thanks, Scott. So just regarding loons, since you brought it up, the subject of my conversation is going to be different, but a lot of loons on the lake west of Minocqua, towards where I believe Scott has a cabin. We have a cabin on a lake, and lots of loons. I've noticed that they're pretty adept at when they see a boat coming, diving down, and I think they avoid a lot of motorized boats that way. But it's there were a lot of loons on this particular lake. But my question is, and I've been saving this one for Scott since I saw this a couple weeks ago on this lake. It's about a 1,000-acre lake with one island, and we were in a pontoon boat and saw a critter swimming in the water, and I thought, you know, it might be a muskrat or maybe a beaver, or maybe an otter. But I slowed down to let the critter go by, and got a closer look, and it was a squirrel swimming. And so I thought, I've never seen anything like this. So I slowed down and I let him go by, and he was leaving one shore and going across a lake. I would say maybe about 600 yards, and we watched him the whole way, swimming straight as a line, got to the other shore, got to a dock across the lake, and was obviously exhausted, climbed up onto the dock and like collapsed and rested. Oh God, it had to be for 5 minutes or so. And then I watched him sprint down the dock and into the woods. And I subsequently learned that squirrels can swim, but I'd never seen anything like this. And I thought Scott might have a comment. I know that there's an island on this lake that we go to, and there's also squirrels on that lake. So I know that, I don't know if they swim back and forth between the mainland or in the island, but I really thought when I saw this, and I wondered if he had any comments.
Well, thanks for thinking about me. My first comment is that that's kind of a neat thing to see. And it brings into focus the fact that when you're outdoors, you never know what you're going to see. And there are many, many different natural history events that go on every day unnoticed that can be pretty exciting when you experience them. So another good reason to spend some time outside. As far as the squirrel swimming, they swim very well. Not that they do it regularly, but if they happen to fall out of a lakeshore tree or something like that, it's no big risk to them. And I'm sure for whatever reason, wanting to get to the island where there may be a squirrel population, or perhaps it was being pursued, whatever reason or whatever its motivation was, they swim very well. But the reality is, I can't think of any animals that, given the opportunity or forced into the situation, can't swim. So in reality, it's probably a more common event than we know. But I've not seen a swimming squirrel like that, and you had a great opportunity.
Yeah, you sure did, Rick. Reminds me of the story of the musky fisherman who was watching a squirrel over a low-hanging branch over the water, and the squirrel was going out to the end because there was an acorn out there, and he got way to the end and fell in the water, and a musky came and grabbed him. And then what really surprised the fisherman was that Muskie came back up and put the acorn back on the end of the branch.
Yeah. Well, that's a good one. Very, Well, there are risks associated with spending time in the water, and muskies and big northern pike are just one of them. But as far as the other issue regarding the loons that Rick brought up, in that they're fully capable of diving and getting out of the way of watercraft, that's certainly true. They're fantastic divers, but my experience on some of those northern lakes in recent years is that the loons have habituated to all this boat traffic, and some of them are incredibly bold. You can be motoring along, so, oh, there's a loon. You should steer clear of it. But, no matter what you try to do, the loons seem to hold their ground. And if you don't make an effort to avoid them, there could be a risk of collision. So don't take for granted when you're boating that the loons are, hey, loon can get out of my way, I'm not worried about it. Well, you should be worried about it, because they may not try until it's too late.
Yeah, so, anyway. good point, Scott. Thank you for that reminder. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Steve in Catawba in Price County. Hi, Steve.
Hey, good morning. Question for your guest about bear hunting. Wondering what he thinks about returning to the system of the past when deer hunters were allowed to shoot bears during deer season. It's not ideal because bears could be shot in their dens, but I'm wondering if it's a more humane way of controlling the population than the current system of running them with dogs trespassing, and grooming them all spring and summer with bait.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's a complicated one, Larry. I realize that the dog hunting, well, both of the main methods, baiting and dog hunting, have their critics, but both methods are very effective. And in terms of controlling the bear population, the DNR can turn on or off that faucet by regulating, as they do, the number of permits that are issued. And the demand for bear permits grossly exceeds the supply, at least in most of the major bear hunting units. I think there are a couple, like perhaps Zone B, that may still take 11 or 12 years of permit application in order for someone to draw a permit to hunt there. So I don't think the idea of having deer hunters shoot bears when they see them is a necessary prerequisite for bear population control. And it might, in some cases, depending on the year, the bears are going into hibernation by then, at least some of them. And the opportunity may not be there. I guess I'd have to think about it a little bit, but I don't. Well, it might provide a little additional bear harvest. It's an opportunistic kind of thing where a deer hunter is sitting there waiting for a deer. Oh, gee, there's a bear. I think I can shoot it. It would be very difficult to regulate with so many tens of thousands of deer hunters in the woods. I don't think that's an idea that's going to gain much traction.
Bear population, I think it's a bit over 26,000, covers about half of the state, if I'm not mistaken, Scott.
Yeah, that's correct. And again, the normal hunting techniques and season and system of tag allocation seems to be capable of keeping a lid on that. The issues of hounds running wherever the bear happens to go and therefore not respecting property lines and things like that, or the ethics of putting out lemon meringue pie filling or stale Twinkies or who knows what all else to attract the bears to it and then shooting them as they're doing little more than eating. I understand the objections to both of those things, but again, they're longstanding tactics in Wisconsin, and they're effective. And I guess if we're going to accept the fact that bears are going to be hunted, the techniques go along with that.
Bernard in Manitowoc emailed to ask, what are the real effects of sandhill cranes on croplands? Bernard said they have observed cranes for over 40 years from marshes in McFarland to crops in northeast Wisconsin and have never witnessed mass damage to fields. They suspect some supporters of a crane hunting season just want a trophy for their wall.
Well, the issue of crop damage is really what's driving the impetus for a crane season. The fact that cranes are hunted in some states, and it's a very popular hunt. They're very wary. They're very good on the dinner table. And the trophy aspect of it, you know, it's a big bird, but so it's not like you're hunting doves where there are lots of them and there's a liberal bag limit. I think if a crane season were put into place, I think I read recently that it would be, again, tightly regulated by tag allocation or application with maybe a starting point of 5,000 permits, I think is what the DNR had said. But back to the crop damage for a minute. First and foremost, I think most people who are interested in cranes are aware that there's a new legislative study committee taking a look at this issue, primarily driven by the possibility of legislation in the future setting up a sandhill crane hunt, but also addressing the issue of crop damage. And they had their first meeting back in early August. I don't know that there's been a second meeting set, but I did hear that the second meeting would focus on crop damage, how widespread, how serious, and so forth. And I know from many years of working at farm technology days and listening to farmers and talking with my colleagues in wildlife services, there are areas of significant crane damage, primarily to the sprouting corn. And in fact, it's enough of an issue that it seems to have warranted billboards along the along Highway 39 going north advertising Avapel, which is one of the repellents that farmers can try to use on their corn to control that problem. But that suggests to me that it is a widely distributed problem of some significance. So if I'm not sure what the caller's or the email author's name was, but I would find out when this next meeting of the study committee, which may be open to a public audience, I don't know that, and it's going to address in some depth the crop damage issue, and that should provide any information that the caller was interested in.
Yeah. Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today. You can join in with your own wildlife question. Number to call, 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Questions, again, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. And just a reminder, epidemiologist for Wisconsin, Rebecca Osborne, will be with us at 12:30 to talk about the recent deaths in Wisconsin from West Nile virus and other mosquito-borne illnesses as well. That's at 12:30. Right now, wildlife on our minds, and Bill and Serona will give you a chance to join in. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. Larry, I have a question for Scott. If he has any knowledge as to whether or not the trumpeter swan population, which has dramatically increased in the last, 6 to 10 years here in northwestern Wisconsin. And I've been told that the trumpeter swan will run the loon off, perhaps in a small lake or pond. And I'm wondering if that has had an effect on the loon population.
Wow, that's an interesting one. I have not heard anything to that effect. And one of the mitigating factors, it seems to me, is that because of the relatively long takeoff and landing zone that a loon, which is an awkward-looking bird in every context except when it's swimming, they need a long runway to get airborne. And as a result, they're rarely seen on small ponds and marshes, which is the kind of habitat the swans would inhabit. So I think there's a little bit of a natural mechanism there that keeps the two birds somewhat separate. On the other hand, you're correct in your assumption that swans are rather aggressive and protective of the wetland or pond they've selected for nesting, to the point that swan decoys are often marketed as something you can float out in your pond or golf course water hazard or whatever to attempt to keep the geese out of the way or anything else that might be bothering the golf course, park, or whatever. And they will chase things off aggressively when they're nesting. I was back in my college days, I was canoeing with my roommate on a small wetland. This was back in New England, and a pair of swans were nesting on the pond, and they saw us, we saw them, and they came across the water paddling, I mean, right up to the canoe, and we thought we were goners. If you've not been that close to a swan, they are big birds. Their feet are like ping pong paddles, and the neck seemed like it was about 8 feet long. And we got the heck out of there. So, yes, they can be aggressive, but again, because of the habitats those animals inhabit, I think there'd be enough separation that that's unlikely to be a major problem. And to be honest, it's not something I've heard about. But interesting idea.
Thanks, Bill. Appreciate it. Jim in Winnebago County, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Morning, Scott. Morning, Larry. I'm wondering if you've heard anything about what the status of Loon Watch is. That was run by the Sigurd Olsen Institute at Northland College, and Northland College is really under the gun. There doesn't look good for their future. And if Northland goes out, the Sigurd Olsen Institute's going to go out, and I wonder what's going to happen with Loon Watch. And secondly, I've also heard that perhaps the loon population may be being affected by wake boat issues. You know anything about that?
Well, I had heard some speculation that, in fact, in that report that I had mentioned, that lake turbidity or clarity, which the theory was that's been degraded by climate change issues and all the rain we've had, assorted other things, made it difficult for the loons to fish successfully. But I've spent a fair bit of time on quite a few bodies of water in the North Woods this year, and that's not something I've observed firsthand. So I don't know that that's an issue. Back to Loon Watch for a bit. I too was concerned about, well, there are a number of things going on at Sigurd Olsen that I thought might be compromised with the financial troubles they were having. But my guess is that the Loon Watch program is so popular that it would likely be picked up by another entity. The individual late Loon Watchers were known as Loon Rangers, and there's a woman on our relatively small lake in Price County who provides all sorts of information to the property owners around the lake, and periodic updates by emails on how the loon pair is doing and whether they have chicks or not and so on. So I think that's a very valuable program, and I'd hate to see it go by the boards because of the problems at Sigurd Olsen, or Northland College, rather. So we'll see what happens. I simply don't know if it's at risk or not.
Hmm. And he also mentioned wake boats as a potential issue for loons.
Well, wake boats have been a trick. I'm glad personally that I didn't invest $150,000 in a wake boat. It's not something I'm interested in anyway. But I think with all of the press and the attention that got at the spring conservation hearings and in other places, that there'll be more and more regulation of where and when wake boats can be used because of a variety of alleged disturbances that the generated waves cause with erosion and all sorts of other things when they're in use. I hadn't heard about that in the context of loon issues.
again, loons are so capable when they're in the water, assuming they would, dive under that or ride out the waves created or whatnot. I'm not sure how much of a problem it would be for loons, but it's getting a lot of attention for other reasons.
Yeah. Mark in Appleton. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Just wanted to comment. One, the bear hunting dates of the season seem to be a little confusing with either misprint in on paper or electronically what was posted. Today is the first day of the bear season here in Wisconsin. And I'll be hunting today with the man who has mentored me in the hunting world for over 50 years. And just wanted to put in a plug for anybody who thinks they might want to mentor someone young. There are many success stories about that being a very effective way to get people into the hunting world.
Yeah. Mark's right. What? The season is September 4th through October 8th. And his comments about mentoring, Scott.
Well, two things. First of all, there was a misprint in a news release. It was quickly corrected by the DNR. Today is the opening day. And what most people don't realize is the two methods we were talking about a little while ago, using bait or using dogs, they actually alternate from one year to the next about which group gets first shot at the bears, so to speak. So the first week this year, starting today, in the zones where it's an issue, is baiting. And then the dogs come online in a week. Next year it'll flip-flop. So that's kind of an interesting situation. But it does open today. And Mark is correct. I think there are ample studies, experience, and anecdotal issues with older hunters such as myself that there is no substitute for having a mentor, whether that's grandpa, dad, cousin, uncle, brother, neighbor, or open-hearted volunteer from a sportsman's organization, anybody to take a young would-be hunter under their wing, or not even a young one, even an a late-onset hunter, take them under their wing, show them the ropes, and that really is the best way, I think, to get them into the sport.
Yeah. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk at WPR.org. Kent emailed to say they have a small pond. They stocked with tadpoles. Now they have green frogs. The tadpoles did overwinter and mature this spring. And Kent wonders if the frogs start calling in their first year, or do they have to mature before they start making those calls?
Well, that's also a good question. And some of the larger frogs, particularly bullfrogs, do take a couple years as tadpoles. So it's not the eggs are laid in the spring. The frogs are out in late summer, not with the bigger ones. But it's, I guess I can't give you the absolute answer, but my impression is once they've metamorphosed and grow rather quickly as a frog now rather than a tadpole, since those larger species are also some of the later singers, I would guess that they do call a little bit at least. But I suspect that like other animals, the main breeding contributors are the mature animals that may be a couple of years old.
James emailed to take issue with your comment when you were talking about bait. You mentioned stale Twinkies, and he says, there is no such thing as a stale Twinkie.
Yes, I understand they have a shelf life of about 10,000 years, but that was kind of tongue-in-cheek. I guess, again, most people who don't participate in the bear hunting scene don't realize how you can – there are places where you can go, including bait shops, convenience stores, gas stations and all, and buy huge quantities of everything from – off the shelf or outdated M&Ms to pie filling to Twinkies to other bakery products. And bears have a sweet tooth, and that's what goes out on the landscape.
Yeah. And Terry in Bayfield County emailed to say that you are absolutely correct, Scott, that the outdoors can be so rewarding if you're patient.
Yes, patient and quiet.
Yeah. patient and quiet. It's amazing what you can see in the woods. I was thinking about...
Well, you know, I called you from the field I was in this morning at sunrise, a sunflower field in Southern Rock County, and it was just a spectacular morning. And there weren't many doves flying, but the reality was it was just such a lovely morning to be out there and see all the other birds that were using those sunflowers that were planted to attract doves. And the sunrise and all sorts of waterfowl flying around, and it's spectacular. You don't need to have a mission like hunting or photography. That just adds to the value. But hey, anybody can get up early and go experience a day like today. It's a good thing.
I remember watching one early fall, probably about this time of the year, watching a squirrel in the woods move her young from one tree, and she'd take one at a time. They'd hold on to her belly. They were underneath her, and they had their paws wrapped around her belly. She would walk them down the tree, go over about 100 feet, climb up another tree, and put them in the new home. And it took a while, but it was so much fun, and I never would have seen it if I'd have been just tromping through. I was just sitting there kind of watching, and I observed that whole process. It was really a lot of fun because I was patient.
There you go. And on the subject of squirrels, I've had two encounters this summer with things I'd never seen before. Gray squirrels have a number of color phases, as we've talked about many times on the show. But in this case, next to my cabin, we have an albino gray squirrel. It absolutely sparkling snow white, pink eyes, just a beautiful animal. But it stood out like a sore thumb on the landscape, and we haven't seen it now for a couple of weeks. So I hope something unpleasant didn't befall it. But that was an unusual sighting. And at the Kemp Natural Resources Station, where I've had a couple workshops this summer, they had an albino red squirrel living under the dining room, kind of in behind some lattice work. And that one was seen by lots of people. So again, you keep your eyes open for just the cool stuff that happens all the time, but also for the rarities like an albino or species you don't see very often.
Yeah. So. Jude in Iola has something for us. Hi, Jude. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. I have three observations of wildlife in my yard this year. More rabbits than I've ever had, and now still the bunnies are coming. I have a really huge groundhog, and he's already digging holes in my woods, getting ready for winter. I've never had that. And lots of chipmunks this year. Everything's getting into my gardens. But one thing that really saddens my heart is I live out in the country, and so I'm always out in my car observing wildlife, and I have not seen one baby sandhill crane at all this year. I've seen a lot of adults, but no babies. Does anybody know what's going on, or do you have any observations of that, please?
Well, Larry, that's a good one on the cranes. I'll comment on that in a second. But, Jude, I'm glad you have lots of rabbits, a big woodchuck, and lots of chipmunks. And please keep them safe where you are, because I've been trying to deal with all three around my property, and it becomes a challenge when you're trying to garden and take care of your landscaping. As far as the cranes are concerned, I don't know what there are a lot of people keeping close eye on this. If you're really curious about it, I'd suggest a phone call or an email or a text to the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo, and there'll be plenty of staff people there who will give you an update on what's going on. In terms of their speculation, I've seen a lot of cranes around this year. I haven't seen a young one either, but I did have a nesting pair. The adults would visit my prairie early in the spring after we burned it, and they were on a small pond maybe a quarter of a mile down the road, but you see them clearly from the road, and we watch them two or three times a day. And the incubating bird
was sitting on the nest, which was on a little mound of soil in this small pond. And this was back when we were getting incredible rains with great frequency, and the nest simply flooded out. The water rose to the point where the nest was inundated, and that nest was lost. So no young cranes produced there. And we did have a lot of water and a lot of temporary wetlands and flooded fields early in the summer this year that you don't usually see except in the spring after snowmelt. So that may have compromised some nesting activity. I don't know if that was widespread or not. But, again, a call to the Crane Foundation would get you your answer.
I had the opportunity this summer, throughout the summer, to observe a pair with a youngster. And over the course of the summer, probably saw them a half a dozen times at least at various stages. And it's nice to see that youngster is getting up bigger. And mom and dad seem proud of it. And they it's been fun to watch that bird grow. Jim in Appleton will give you a chance. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. A couple of weeks ago, I was hiking on Rock Island State Park, which was fantastic in and of itself. But there was a squirrel, I believe, a squirrel that ran across the trail in front of me, very black, extraordinarily long tail, and the tail had a white tip on the end of it. And that's not an animal I'm familiar with. I'm wondering if you could identify that for me.
Maybe an ermine?
I think it was probably just what you thought it was, Jim. It was a black squirrel. There have been lots of them this year up in the North Woods. That's always the stronghold for the black color phase. And it's a perfectly normal gray squirrel in every other way, but it's jet black. I mean, really jet black. And they're usually entirely jet black. The fact that it had a white tip on its tail, sometimes there's a bit of an injury and the hair grows in a different color or whatever. There are a variety of reasons for that. But I think you apply the test if it looks like a squirrel and is behaving like a squirrel and so forth, it's probably a squirrel. Because we don't have that many animals that are jet black in the state. Other than skunks, and they have varying degrees of white striping and marking. There are a few animals with the normal white tip on their tail, but things like a red fox and all, but would have been much larger. And I don't know of a melanistic or black one, so I think it was just a black squirrel.
Mark in Green Bay will go to you. Hi, Mark.
Oh, hi. I'm calling to express my disgust with the obscenity of this early teal season. It's a joke. All it is a second opener, an early opener for duck hunting. On the opening day, this would have been Sunday, we had an excess of 40 shots or fired before the opening of the season, which is at sunrise, not a half hour before. But apparently duck hunters are too stupid to read the regulations. On Monday, we had nearly 50 shots. I called into the DNR tip line. They said they're overwhelmed with calls coming in from there. So a warden called me back later on. Nice guy. His assigned area is over 60 miles long from the mouth of the Fox River to the Menominee River. He can only work 8 hours a day. Well, there's no enforcement. Everybody knows it. Everyone just burns off whatever duck flies. The canard is, if it flies, it dies. The teal season, this has to change. It's just, it's crazy.
Well, where should I start? First of all, the teal season is just a week-long opportunity to take advantage of a duck population that's kind of a here-today, gone-tomorrow thing. They tend to leave our area fairly quickly. So back when this was put into play, the Fish and Wildlife Service offered it up as an experimental early teal season. And they were doing some pretty close monitoring on compliance, particularly in terms of the early complaint was, well, hunters are going to shoot lots of different things, either by mistake or illegally, intentionally, whatever you want to call it. So that wood ducks and other local species, especially the smaller ones,
would suffer collateral damage. They did that for at least 1 year, and I think it was maybe two or three. And whatever studies, you know, blind observations or whatever they had suggested that their concerns were not warranted, and they went ahead and implemented the early teal season as an opportunity to take advantage of that resource while it's here, instead of waiting until the traditional duck opener toward the end of September when the teal are often in short supply. I haven't heard of any particular problems with impacts on other duck species, but the lousy behavior you mentioned in terms of early shooting and other things prone to cause problems, sky busting and overbagging and wrong species identification and so forth, are just an unfortunate manifestation of damn poor outdoor behavior. The fact that the warden force is thinly spread in terms of distribution and time available simply means, as you suggest, that the probability of apprehension is very low. And I certainly don't have a great deal of respect for people who are out there allegedly enjoying our outdoor resource, but perhaps think that, hey, I can get away with just about anything because the likelihood of encountering a warden is very low, at least in that context. So it's, you know, it's bad behavior, but I guess I chalk it right up there with speeding on the highway, running red lights, and a whole slew of other examples of poor human behavior, I guess. And it doesn't, I hate to finger the hunters here, because I think you could look at a lot of segments of society, including people at sporting events and all sorts of other things, where there's poor behavior, and that's really what this is.
Yeah.
But the early teal season has been going along without, I think, major biological impacts, and therefore it's continuing. But the poor behavior, that's another matter.
Scott Craven, our guest today, UW Extension wildlife ecologist and emeritus professor at UW. I'm Larry Mueller. Looking at the world of wildlife with the UW Extension wildlife ecologist, emeritus professor Scott Craven. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Karen in Madison next. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Larry and Scott. I just wait for Scott to come on. Love it. Okay, I have a question. I'm going to stay on topic here. There's a rabbit in my yard, a rabbit and a bunny, and I think they're related. They have a white star on their head. That's very particular to them. But they're very friendly, but this rabbit was sound asleep in my yard. There, it's 90 degrees and humid, and, you know, it doesn't matter. It's out there sleeping. And so I went over to it, and when you say I have the patience of a saint, but when I talk, the animals come instead of run. But I went over to it, and it didn't wake up. And I finally thought it's dead or something's wrong. And finally, its nose, you know, just trickled a little bit. So then I knew it was alive. And I kept saying, bunny, bunny, it's me, you know. And finally, its ear moved. This took about a couple minutes, 3 minutes or something. And then finally, I put a little bit of corn and sunflower about a foot away from it. So the chipmunks, because there are so many chipmunks that mow everything down. And finally it got up on its feet and came over and put its, you know, ate it. Is that normal, or can rabbits get narcolepsy, or can they sleep so soundly that a human, even if they know it, can stand right over top of it?
Okay. Well, Scott, have we got a narcoleptic rabbit here?
Well, I doubt it, but I'm certainly not an expert on rabbit physiological conditions, but it's not normal for a rabbit to simply behave in a comatose fashion and allow itself to be approached like that. That's not a great survival strategy. Now, in this case, that rabbit was lucky. It was Karen, who was willing to communicate with it and help it out and so forth. But it's possible that the extreme heat, which we had a week or so ago, may have just temporarily stunned it or whatnot. But it apparently was out in the open, and that's not normal behavior for a rabbit either, especially in broad daylight on a hot day. So it seems to me there was something wrong with that rabbit, but I don't know what it was.
Yeah.
And unusual markings and so forth. It's also possible that that was a rabbit raised in captivity at some point that, got away, got released in the neighborhood or whatnot, and didn't have normal fear of people to begin with. So I don't know. A lot of possible explanations for that, but nothing that's very obvious.
Yeah. Karen, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. They do sleep a lot during the day, rabbits.
They do, because they're primarily operative, dawn and dusk and over the night. But, Larry, I found a survey the other day of Michigan hunters, and this is kind of related to the caller who was very concerned about waterfowl hunter behavior. And I guess I'd just like to comment this. This study caught my attention because there's some pushback in Wisconsin to trying to go back to with deer hunting, which is our big ticket item in the state, so to speak, to go back to some of the things that were some of the aspects of deer management that were eliminated when we were more or less told by the legislature administration to implement all of the provisions of the so-called Deer Czar report back in 2012. And, one of those deals with registration and in-person registration was sent packing, and it's all done on phones and so forth now, which is fine. And I use that convenience myself. But this study suggested that this was done in Michigan, and that some 30% of Michigan deer hunters actually failed to report their deer harvests electronically. It was over the phone reporting. And that's, that's a third. That's a significant hole in the information when the agency's trying to keep track of how many deer are being harvested and where and when and so forth. So that concerned me a little bit, but it's another comment related to the point that hunter behavior in terms of following regulations or just being inconsiderate and so forth is very damaging to the view that the general public has of hunting. And the general public over the years has generally been very supportive of recreational hunting, especially when the meat is properly utilized. And I hate to see that eroded, but I think that poor behavior, whether it's early shooting in a duck marsh near somebody's house, or failing to follow the regulations of registration, or any number of things, is one of the quickest ways to erode support for hunting that hunters should be darn concerned about. So anyway, just another point.
A listener, just quickly before we break, a listener emailed to ask if the mute swan Scott encountered canoeing was out east. Given the rarity of trumpeter swans, it would seem this encounter was likely with a breeding mute swan.
It was. But in the context of being in a canoe and being attacked by what seemed like a 6-foot-tall bird, we viewed a swan as a swan. But those were definitely mute swans.
There we go. And you were out east. Yeah. Scott Craven, our guest today. And Scott will be with us right up until 12:30 today. And you can join in. Got a call from Blake in State College, Pennsylvania. What about you? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Looking at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Always great to have Scott come by. Our lines are filled and we have some number of emails. So let's go back to the phones here. And Blake in State College, Pennsylvania. Hi, Blake.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, no problem. My question was, so the rabbits lately have been eating my garden a lot. So how do you suppose I take care of that?
Well, an interesting and relatively common question. I would say that the frequency of that question diminishes over the course of the summer, because right now everyone's gardens are beginning to fade away and have been so productive that sharing a bit with the rabbits isn't as much of a problem as it might have been when the plants are first coming up. But in any event, this is something we've talked about for years, and the first line of defense, if you're going to garden, you need a fence, plain and simple. If you don't have some sort of a good fence that's rabbit-proof and woodchuck-proof and deer-proof around your garden, eventually you're going to have problems with one of those species. So a good fence is number one. Number two, a more proactive approach in terms of reducing the rabbit population. And your choice of tools from the toolbox, live trap and haul them away. If you're in the countryside, shooting them. I realize that people have different viewpoints on those strategies, but fence, reduce the rabbit population, and third, the use of a variety of repellents that your garden stores can help, garden centers can help you out with, ranging from blood meal to chemical sprays and assorted other things that will deter their damage. So that kind of covers the litany of options, Larry.
Blake, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Tom in Green Bay.
It's probably worth mentioning to the listeners who are in the dark on this. Why is somebody calling from Penn State University? And that was my grandson. he's in his first 2 weeks out at Penn State as a freshman, and I hope he's going to class and not spending all his time on the radio, even though this show is riveting. Anyway, let's move on.
Blake, yeah, thank you for calling, Blake. It's good to hear your voice. Tom in Green Bay, we go to you now. Hi, Tom.
Hi there. On your mute swans, there are two records down in Illinois and Indiana of people being killed by mute swans. One was an elderly fisherman sitting in his boat, and he got attacked from behind and ended up drowning. And the other one was somebody on a jet ski who got nailed. Up here at Green Bay, we had a lady, and they had a pond, a little sanctuary in their yard, and they had a nesting pair of mute swans. And one day she was walking, not on the water, and she was just walking, and she got too close to the nest, and she ended up in the hospital with a broken leg and a broken arm. And I also have an old friend who's now gone that used to be a manager at a game farm, and he went out to check some traps one morning that he had for raccoons, because it was a waterfowl sanctuary. And he was walking past a mute swan nest, and she came out, and she came after him. He held out his shotgun, and the bird took the stock right off the gun.
Well, I feel vindicated in being scared half out of my mind when that thing attacked us in the canoe, but they're big and powerful, so... we've talked a number of times today about the joys of being outdoors and being observant and so forth. But, you know, the follow-up to that is be well aware of the fact that what you're out there looking at are wild animals, some of which are large and unpredictable. And be sure you know what your course of action should be if you have an interaction with any wild animal that it seems to be going south. So.
Thanks a lot. Arlen in Okano County, your turn. Hi, Arlen.
Hello, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I just got a quick question here for Scott. About 3 weeks ago, maybe a month, first of all, we got a lot of deer that walk across our backyard here between the house and the woods. We see them all the time, bucks and does and fawns. But anyway, this buck in velvet, a sizable buck, not a trophy, but a respectable buck, probably a couple years old at least, walked across the backyard, a stretch for probably, almost 100 yards across there. And right behind him were two fawns, and they were following him. And he was going at a steady pace, not fast, but steady and in a straight line, like he had some place to go. And these two fawns were following right behind him and keeping in step with him. I'd never seen anything like that before. What do you think?
When was this, Arlen? Recently?
Yeah, probably 3 weeks ago or so.
Well, it's probably more likely to occur now as the fawns are beginning to get some age and size to them. And, you know, who knows whether that was a long line of deer moving in one direction and, you know, you happen to see a couple of segments of it. Maybe there was a doe in there, maybe there wasn't, but depending on who else for deer was in the neighborhood, I could see the fawns following a buck along, perhaps not knowing what else to do. And the doe may have well been somewhere nearby, but out of sight. I've had fawns in the woods follow me, but they were mostly younger ones that seemed dazed and confused and were looking to follow anything that might feed them or take care of them or whatever. So I don't know what the actual explanation was, but this time of year, it's not surprising to see deer together in the sense of at least moving toward a common, whether it's feeding area, bedding area, shade, or whatever. So I don't know what more to say about it than that, but
much less likely would be that the horned deer was a doe with horns.
Well, that's another possibility, an unusual one, but that does happen. So, yeah, there you go. Good thought, Larry.
Arlen, thanks for calling. Arshan in Beaver Dam, it's your turn. Hi, Arshan.
Hi, thanks. I have a couple of questions about robins. We've had a robin's nest outside our kitchen window for a few years and have really enjoyed watching the nesting process and the babies hatch. One question I have is it the same robin likely to be coming back to the same nest every year? And this year, we had three different batches of babies born. And the third time, they were getting ready almost to leave the nest. And I came out one morning just to check on the status. And I saw that the nest had been knocked off the place where it was. It was on a light box about 5 feet off the ground under the eaves of the house. The nest had been knocked off and the babies were dead because they had fallen and so on. I'm wondering what might have taken that nest overnight. And like I said, is it the same robin coming back every year?
Well, as far as the same robin coming back, it certainly could be. But the life expectancy of many of our songbirds is relatively short. And not only might it be the same robin for several years, which it could be, but it could also be a bird that had been produced in that nest and it's, you know, coming back. They're reasonably faithful to a particular part of the landscape, so it could have been an offspring. Or it could have been a completely different bird. But if they're coming back and using the same nest and, you know, exactly the same nest site, it's likely the same bird or at least an offspring that's familiar with the area. As far as what knocked the nest off the platform, no telling, but there are lots of possible culprits. If it happened at night, raccoon or cat are both possibilities. If it happened, well, I guess it doesn't matter when it happened. Could have also been a squirrel. Gray squirrels will feed on nestlings and eggs if given the opportunity, and they're certainly agile enough to get to a site like that and knock it off, although I would have expected them to maybe take the nestlings as a reward for their effort. So there are a couple possibilities, and there's no way to know for sure unless you monitor the nest with a trail camera or you've got your Ring doorbell camera trained on it so you can keep an eye on things. There are a variety of surveillance techniques if you want to try that in the future. But other than that, we're just speculating.
Yeah. Arshan, thank you for calling. Eli in Racine, your turn. Hi.
Hello, sir. Excited to talk with you. So I recently saw, just 2 days ago, I live in Racine, I saw on Washington Avenue above me a pack of whooping cranes, which was, I think, an opportunity of a lifetime to see. I know there's only hundreds of them that exist in this region. And I just want to know, whereabouts could I see more? Because I thought it was a truly remarkable experience, but, you know, if I had my camera with me, I could really capture the moment. So what do you suppose I could do for that?
And you're relatively sure, Eli, that these were whooping cranes?
I am relatively sure. My sister is a bird enthusiast, and I was in shock myself. I was very careful. I know I had the red head, the white body, you know, and the black tips. I was certain of it.
And when was this, Eli?
Yeah, so this was 2 days ago, and okay. It was probably like mid noon on Washington Avenue in Racine.
Interesting. Well, first of all, that's an unusual thing. Whooping cranes have been a lot of time, money, and effort going back into the restoration of whooping crane populations, and it's gotten a lot of publicity because of the various programs like Flying South with the flocks of captive reared cranes with ultralight aircraft and so on. But they are coming back in the state. But how many were there?
I would say about a half dozen or so.
Well, I guess the main thing I would urge you to do is pass this along to the folks in the DNR's Natural Heritage Inventory, formerly the Bureau of Endangered Resources, at the Madison office, and ask to speak to somebody who's involved in the crane program and report that sighting in terms of location and timing and so forth. They'll want to know, and if you have trouble reaching them, same advice I gave to the person interested in sandhill cranes and depredations, and that's to give somebody at the International Crane Foundation a call and let them know where these birds were. A lot of them are marked, and if it was just a couple of days ago, they may still be in the area, and there may be an opportunity to get some more information as to where those birds originated or where they might be headed. So anyway, it's really cool observation. You gave a pretty good description of the bird, so I don't think there's any question there. But what their origin was and where they were headed, we don't know.
Yeah.
So, but I think that's one of those things that's a bit of information that the people who have been involved in the crane program would like to know about.
Yeah. Thanks, Eli, for calling. Gene from Minnesota, but driving across Wisconsin. Hi, Gene.
Hi there. Enjoying listening to your program as I'm driving.
Thank you.
I've got a cabin in northern Minnesota with a deck and a brick walkway, and I've got woodchucks under it. I've live trapped them, and they keep coming back, and they keep digging tunnels under my brick walkway, and I have to replace it every year. How do I get rid of woodchucks? Is there a way to put a fence down? And if I only put it down to ground level, will it keep them out?
Mm-hmm. Gene, this is your lucky day, because the host of this program on public radio is an expert on dealing with lakeshore woodchucks under a deck and has a long history of removal. So, Larry, what worked for you?
Well, I trapped them out. I trapped 11 one summer on my lake home, and then and released them. But they're easily trapped, or usually easily trapped. I was able to do it with just some with an appropriately sized trap. With a little bait in it, some fresh vegetables. I don't remember if I ever used peanut butter, but I think I used fresh vegetables all the time and was able to quickly, day by day. And then I solved the problem by taking off the deck and putting in a patio, which eliminated not only the woodchucks, but the raccoons and everybody else who wanted to be under it. So there you go. And if you want to keep the deck, you're gonna have to trap them out, and then you're gonna have to animal proof the deck.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say, Gene. You can keep trapping, but they'll keep coming. I would first put a liberal dose of moth flakes or naphthalene under there, or some ammonia-soaked rags, and make sure they're out. And then I'd skirt the deck. I don't know how high it is off the ground. Aesthetically, you may not be able to do that. But the only foolproof technique is to use hardware cloth or welded wire. It can be spray painted to match the color of the deck for the house, so it's not too obtrusive. But skirt the whole deck so that they just can't get under there. But they're great diggers, so you usually have to put a flange on the bottom of that screening. In other words, if it's a piece of welded wire, bend it out in an L, a foot or two, and then put that down under the soil surface so that if an animal comes to the skirting and digs down to go under it, they're going to hit the flange, and they won't get under that. So that's the long-term solution, and good luck.
Good luck. Mark in Sussex, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, thanks for taking my call. A funny story about some turkeys and a fawn. I have a couple huge tom turkeys that have been residents here for quite a while. And last week, a little fawn came walking up to them, bobbing its head and kind of looking at them, you know, real curious. The turkeys would stand up, flap their wings. The fawn would run away, and they'd come back. And this went on for a couple minutes. Finally, the turkeys got up, flapped their wings, and started running away, and the fawn chased them.
Friend of mine, Bob Cooney, observed a very similar with the turkeys and the young fawns sort of chasing each other back and forth. Pretty cool behavior, Scott.
Yeah, it's all part of what kind of the theme for today has been. You know, if you spend some time outside and you're observant and relatively quiet, you'll see all sorts of neat stuff eventually, some of which will be a once-in-a-lifetime occurrence. On the subject of being observant, can I mention a couple of things that have been in the news, Larry, that people may be hearing about?
Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
Well, one, these are some things that have attracted a lot of interest, both here in Wisconsin, and here in Wisconsin they should attract some interest, even though they're national issues. And they all relate to conservation and wildlife management. One is the huge eradication plan that the Fish and Wildlife Service is planning to, over a 10-year period, kill upwards of 400,000 owls. Is that for, let me see.
Barred
owls. 452,000 is the target. Barred owls. Barred owls are very common here in Wisconsin. It's the owl that most people hear in the evening doing the who cooks for you sound. And they're very invasive and aggressive, and they've moved into the Pacific Northwest and are apparently a big threat to the conservation and security of the spotted owls that people should or would remember from the Clinton administration, when there were major sanctions put on the timber industry in the Pacific Northwest, again, to protect these spotted owls. And that was very contentious, and I can only imagine how contentious a proposal to kill several hundred thousand owls with trained shooters to protect what apparently is a range that holds only about 7,000 spotted owls. And even within the agency, I think there's some contentiousness over this. So if this kind of gets you a little agitated or curious, follow along with what's going on for that. The other issue is here at home, and that's the huge solar array, a huge solar development planned for central Wisconsin in and around the Buena Vista area, which is the last stronghold of greater prairie chickens in Wisconsin. And there's been a lot of attention given to that, and many people offered up public comment. I think they're still in the review phase now of assessing all those comments to see what they're going to do. But there were some very thoughtful comments about how to rearrange some of the siting and so forth to have both the solar arrays and the prairie chickens.
And the last one, in just a second or two, there are things going on that everybody ought to keep an eye on. The state of Utah, for example, in their legislature, are making an effort to take what I think are millions of acres of public lands and essentially give those back to the state for purposes of sale, development, or what have you. And these are Utah's, I think, primarily public land at BLM and other agencies. And this is, you know, this is our land. We may be here in Wisconsin, but federal lands in the West are federal property. Essentially, they belong to all of us, and they're open for recreation and hunting and hiking and biking and all sorts of things. I think everybody has to be aware of this kind of thing going on, and where they have an opportunity to make public comment, I think people from a long ways away from, in this case, Utah, have an opportunity to have their voice heard and maybe even have more impact than local folks who would obviously be upset. So anyway, just a few things that have been in the news, but I thought the owl eradication would stimulate the most interest. And I'm glad we're doing it at the end of the program, so there's not much time for comment.
A caller, I want to get this in. A caller wonders, is it illegal to feed deer on private property? The caller asks because a neighbor of theirs is doing that, which has resulted in deer eating the flowers in the caller's garden.
It doesn't matter whether it's public, certainly public land, but most of Wisconsin is private land, and deer feeding is banned in every county that is adjoining or has been affected by chronic wasting disease. And it's not a matter of trying to restrict the public's enjoyment of feeding and seeing deer. It's one of a relatively few things that they feel can be done to at least slow the spread of chronic wasting disease. So yes, I mean, see if your county's in the ban, and if it is, then blatantly feeding deer in an area that's affected by CWD is illegal. So.
And on that happy note, Scott, thank you so much. Always a pleasure, and we'll look forward to your next visit in a couple of months.
Okay, see you then. Have a good fall, everybody.
Scott Craven, our guest today, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. He comes by every couple of months, every other month, to talk with us about wildlife issues. David Drake and Jamie Knack from Wildlife Ecology come in the odd month with them. So coming up, we're going to take a look at some mosquito-borne threats here in Wisconsin with our next guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're turning our attention to mosquitoes a bit. This summer, two Wisconsin residents died, and another was hospitalized with West Nile virus. And this summer, a person was hospitalized in Wisconsin with Eastern equine encephalitis, also spread by infected mosquitoes. That disease has killed people throughout New England. There are ways to protect yourself against these viruses and Lyme disease, which is also carried by deer ticks. Larry Mueller here. My guest now, Rebecca Osborne, epidemiologist specializing in vector-borne diseases for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. And as we talk with Rebecca Osborne, I hope you'll join in. How can you protect yourself from these diseases? You have symptoms or questions about treatment? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Rebecca Osborne, thank you so much for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, let's take EEE. This summer, a rare mosquito-borne virus, it's called Eastern Equine Encephalitis, killed a New Hampshire resident, the first reported fatal case in that state since, I think, 2014. What do we know about Eastern equine encephalitis?
Yeah, it is unfortunately a very serious disease. It is thankfully quite rare in the United States and in Wisconsin, but there are certainly some cases that can be reported in the country every year. And unfortunately, the people who do get sick from this disease, sometimes you might hear it called triple E because it does have such a long name, are often hospitalized. And unfortunately, there's about a 30% fatality rate. So of the people that get really sick, about 30% of them do die from triple E. So while being very rare, it is very serious. So we try and keep very close tabs on this disease and the activity that we detect, we try and report promptly to the public.
And there's no treatment for it, is there, or am I wrong?
No, you're right. There is no specific antiviral treatment. You know, antibiotics don't work because this is a virus. Unfortunately, when a patient is really sick with triple E virus, the only thing a doctor can do is sort of treat the symptoms themselves. So they're trying to control inflammation of the brain, trying to make sure this person has, you know, enough antibodies that are fighting off the virus and so on. But there is no specific medication to cure triple E virus. So it's unfortunate that we don't have those tools, but it is the situation that we're currently in.
Yeah. And in July, we had one person hospitalized in Wisconsin with triple E. Are mosquitoes in this state carrying the virus?
Yes. Yeah, so that is a really good question. And this is one of those quirks about public health surveillance. We do have a case of triple E in a Wisconsin resident, and upon investigating the case, which is what public health authorities do for these types of diseases, it was determined that this person most likely acquired the infection outside of Wisconsin in a New England state. So we don't have any evidence currently that mosquitoes in Wisconsin are carrying and transmitting this triple E virus. Now, that being said, that doesn't mean that there is no risk. Sometimes, you know, mosquitoes can carry this virus without us detecting it until, unfortunately, somebody gets sick. But all the evidence that we have right now suggests that there is likely very low levels, if not no levels, of triple E virus currently circulating. But the risk of triple E and other mosquito-borne viruses will continue until you know, through the rest of the summer and into the fall, typically until the temperatures really drop.
Yeah. Well, one problem we can, or virus we do have in Wisconsin, if I'm not mistaken, is West Nile. And this summer, two Wisconsin residents did die of West Nile virus. I think a third person in the state was hospitalized. How does the West Nile virus compare to the triple E in the way it sickens people?
Yeah, so West Nile is more common than triple E virus. These are, again, both viruses that are spread by mosquitoes. Very similar in that they can sometimes cause, you know, a flu-like illness. So this is something that would cause a fever and body aches and muscle pains and fatigue, and you're just going to feel really crummy. It's not going to typically involve respiratory symptoms. So unlike, you know, some other viruses that can circulate, you're not going to have a, you know, congestion or a cough typically, but these other symptoms are very common. That's what we call sort of West Nile fever or Eastern equine encephalitis fever. Those are the more mild cases, but both of these viruses can, in some individuals, go on to become very serious. And this is, again, commonly showing signs of inflammation of the brain, seizures, you know, confusion, sort of mental changes, and unfortunately can sometimes lead to death. West Nile is typically not as serious, so it causes fewer deaths, about a 10% fatality rate compared to triple E, which is about a 30% fatality rate. But as we've seen, unfortunately, already in our state, we've already had two Wisconsin residents who have died with West Nile virus, and we hope that there are no more, but you know, there might be more people who get severely ill and may die from this disease.
I'm wondering, how does the Wisconsin Department of Health Services keep track of cases, and what's your role as an epidemiologist?
So we here at the State Health Department, our part of responsibilities are to try and track these reportable diseases. So West Nile virus and Triple E virus and several other diseases spread by mosquitoes and ticks are what we call reportable or notifiable to the state. So this means that a laboratory or a hospital or a clinic that might either diagnose somebody with one of these diseases or test them for one of these diseases, and the test is positive, that information gets reported into our surveillance system for the state. And so what we then do is do a little bit of follow-up or investigation with our local and tribal health department partners and try and get some additional information about, you know, where did this person get exposed? What were their symptoms? Were they treated or hospitalized, and so on? And then we use that information to not only, learn more about that disease, sort of what symptoms it might cause in people, who is affected, right? What age groups, what location, other factors that might be important for people who are at risk. We use that to learn more about the disease. And then we also share that information as needed with the public to as sort of an alert, right? Hey, we found that people are getting sick from this disease. So it can help inform the public that these diseases are here. You know, the risk is current, you know, right now, and mosquitoes are active. And so it's time to think about that when you go outside and try and take precautions. So we're just trying to track these diseases, their movements, who's affected, and hopefully in the end, prevent them is the goal.
And I'm thinking about West Nile. It's my understanding that the majority of people who contract West Nile virus don't have symptoms. Is there any way to know how then do we know they were infected? Let's put it that way.
Yeah, right. So maybe this is good news, right? That a lot of people who get infected with West Nile virus will never develop symptoms, never know they're infected, and thankfully will develop immunity to the infection and likely not get the disease at all going forward. So that's the good news. But it can be tricky to know, am I protected? And have I had this infection or not? And there really isn't a great way to tell. You could certainly talk to your doctor if you have questions about this, but there's not really a test they can run to say, yes, you're immune. They could potentially run an antibody test for a type of antibody that can develop during infection, but then remains elevated for years afterward. It's called an IgG antibody. This test can sometimes indicate past infection with a disease like West Nile virus, and may be informative if you're somebody who's in that high-risk group. And what I mean by that is, really, we see the people who have severe disease are typically of an older age, so people over 65, and people who have immunocompromising conditions, so might be undergoing chemotherapy for cancer, might have just had an organ transplant, people who might be taking medications to weaken their immune system. If you're in one or both of those groups, you might be at a higher risk for developing severe illness, and it might be something you want to talk to your doctor about, whether or not it's worth running a test to see if you have antibodies.
And on the West Nile, I think that virus has been found in donated blood. Is that correct?
Yes. So this is a universal screening system done by blood collection agencies, and this is to protect the blood supply. The reasoning behind this, right, is that you could have gotten West Nile virus and not develop symptoms. So you feel perfectly healthy and you go to donate blood, which is a wonderful thing. You know, we need a lot of blood donors. And maybe your blood is infected with West Nile and you don't realize it. So all blood collection agencies in the United States will screen blood donors for West Nile virus. And this test is typically run, and then if it's positive, that result will get reported to public health. for the reasons we all talked about before, you know, so that we can track the infections and we can kind of investigate what's going on with this particular individual. So we have detected some of those individuals in Wisconsin as well. And again, it helps us know where the virus is circulating in the state, so we can help warn the public. It's, you know, it appears to be here and circulating in mosquitoes in this area. So take precautions against mosquito bites.
And so precautions, I guess, insect repellent would be one. What else could we think about?
Yeah, so insect repellent is a great option. I know there's a lot of products out there. So we typically recommend an EPA or Environmental Protection Agency registered product. That would include DEET and others like picaridin, or there's oil of lemon eucalyptus and a few others that you can look up. If you go to the EPA website, they have a great page that talks about all the different repellents and kind of their intended use and efficacy. So what are they effective at preventing? So those are great options. The other thing that I like to do and recommend to other people that has great evidence in supporting its use is using permethrin. This is a chemical that doesn't go on your skin, but it goes in on your clothing. It does take a little bit of planning because you want to do it in advance of going outside where you might be exposed to mosquitoes. This also works for ticks as well. You spray your clothing with this permethrin spray, and it embeds into the material, and it both repels and upon contact can kill a lot of ticks and mosquitoes if they do come into contact with you. So this will last several washings on your clothing, and it's great. I do this for myself, and I'll throw on my long sleeve shirt and long sleeve pants that are embedded with permethrin when I know I'm going to be outside where ticks are active or when mosquitoes are active, and that helps me feel protected. There's a few other things that we recommend too that are pretty easy. Like if you're sitting outside in your yard having a nice gathering, maybe you're sitting around a barbecue or a fire, you can set up some fans. Mosquitoes in particular are really poor flyers. They can't fly very well through even just a slight wind. So if you have some fans going, that can really keep the mosquitoes away from you because they just can't make it through that little breeze that the fan is creating. So there's several options for thinking about prevention, but we certainly recommend insect repellents and permethrin if you can do it, and then just avoiding those times and places where mosquitoes might be active.
And I also make sure that I kind of make sure that the water is changed in my bird bath. If it hangs around for a long time, I think mosquitoes can breed in how many days? You want to get rid of standing water, I think.
Yes, that's a great one too. So if you have a home where you might have standing water around it, whether that's a bird bath or pet bowls or flower pots, rain gutters, or any other sort of animal water tanks or anything like that, if you can, drain that water, replace it, dump it out every few days. So yeah, mosquitoes will often lay their eggs right in the water. All of the baby mosquitoes, or we call them larval mosquitoes, do require water to survive. So they're fully aquatic. And so they'll need to develop in that water before they hatch into adult mosquitoes who can fly around and then bite you. So if you try and remove a lot of that standing water from your property, we recommend every 3 to 5 days, if you can dump and clean out that water and replace it, that'll certainly keep the mosquitoes from developing in those small little containers. And it can be as little as a few inches of water in a very small container can still be perfect breeding habitat for mosquitoes.
Rebecca Osborne, our guest today, epidemiologist specializing in vector-borne diseases for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. I want to ask her about Lyme disease, too. You may have a question, and I hope you join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at mosquito-borne illnesses today with our guest, Rebecca Osborne, epidemiologist with the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Great to have Rebecca with us today. Questions for her? Join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email address talk at WPR.org. That's talk at WPR.org. Love to hear from you. We're talking about Triple E, equine encephalitis, Eastern equine encephalitis. We've talked about West Nile virus, and I also want to get into Lyme disease with Rebecca as well. So look forward to hearing from you. Lyme disease, Wisconsin reports a huge, well, the highest annual cases of Lyme disease, which of course is spread by deer ticks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Wisconsin is unfortunately one of the high incidence states for Lyme. This means we have lots of cases every year, and we expect to have lots of cases every year. This is a disease that is spread by a really tiny tick called the deer tick. And it's one of those small ticks that can bite you and go undetected. So it's a pretty tricky one to find. So we also recommend a lot of the same things that would prevent mosquito bites. We recommend to do those same things to prevent tick bites. So a lot of the same insect repellents that are effective against mosquito bites will work for ticks as well. The permethrin embedded in your clothing is another great one for ticks and mosquitoes. Fans won't help with ticks, but things like staying away from tall vegetation can help. Trying to do your tick checks when you're done from coming outside, showering within 2 hours after coming indoors, things like that can help keep yourself from getting tick bites. But it is a tricky one to find. So we encourage multiple prevention strategies if you can.
Permethrin embedded in your clothing, it's, well, I've never had a tick bite since I've been using it, so I'm happy for that. Paul in Western Wisconsin has something, I think maybe back to Triple E. Let's go there. Hi, Paul.
Hey, how you doing, Larry? Just wanted to share that I think it was about 15 years ago, my father-in-law in about the middle of fall overcame with a headache over the weekend, a few days later became unresponsive, and unfortunately, it took quite a while for the diagnosis, but he was one of the people that had Eastern equine encephalitis. I think that year, again, I think it was 15 years ago, as I recall, I think there were 6 cases in the country. He became unresponsive. It took quite a while for the diagnosis to come back, but it did come back from the CDC. And it seemed just strange just because it was fall and it was, I think there had already been a frost, may not have been a real hard frost, but it was kind of unexpected seasonally.
And he was in Wisconsin, Paul?
Correct, in northern Wisconsin, yeah, above Highway 8.
Hmm. Comment? Wow. Yeah, comment, Rebecca?
Yeah, I'm so sorry. It can be a very, very devastating illness. And that's a great point that you bring up about the seasonality. You know, people often think of mosquitoes being active in the summer, which is of course true, but we have seen mosquito activity, including mosquito-borne disease cases reported well into the fall. We've had cases reported in October and even November. And as we start to see shifts towards more mild winters, this could be extended even further. So mosquitoes are more cold hardy than you might imagine. Certainly we'll start to see their activity go down as the temperatures start to decline, but it doesn't mean that they're going to completely stop being active until we get really, really cold temperatures. Usually at least a hard frost will knock down quite a few of them. Maybe some took refuge in, you know, these really small microclimates where they can survive those. So it's still important to sort of keep that in mind. I'm so sorry to hear about your family member. And I don't know how this person's doing, but often people who do survive Triple E still have ongoing, you know, problems, residual problems from the illness. So it can be really, really devastating.
Yeah. Actually, unfortunately, Paul's grandfather died from it. So it's too bad. But Paul, sorry for your loss, but thank you for sharing the information with us. Appreciate it very much. Sandy in Rhinelander, it's your turn. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. So I know I'm not saying this right, that Permethrin.
Permethrin, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. So I have cats, and I'm always concerned about using that because, you know, even when I'm outside, my cats like me to hold them, and I've heard that that's not good for cats neurologically.
Yeah, that's a great point to bring up, and we always want to think about not only human health, but animal health, and I know a lot of people have their beloved pets, including myself, so if possible, you know, you can certainly look at other alternatives. If you are concerned about your animal, especially cats, coming into contact with permethrin, you can use the topical insect repellents that would go on your skin. If you do really want to try permethrin, one thing you could consider, I don't know if this is an option, but you could try and find a location, ideally outdoors, where you can spray the permethrin where it's very well, you know, aerated and there's a lot of good circulation. And where you can keep your cats away, I don't know if you can exclude them from that area for at least a certain amount of time, keep them indoors or put them in an area where they can stay away from this location. Once the permethrin has dried on your clothing, which might take anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour, depending on the temperature outside and kind of where the clothes are. Once the permethrin has dried, it should not be a danger at all to your cats. So it's really just keeping them away from the area where you're spraying it and when the clothing is wet. And after that, once it's dried, there should be no concern with coming into contact with your animals.
Would that hold true with the clothing that has been already permeated with permethrin?
Yeah, right. So there are clothes that are already embedded with permethrin that you can purchase directly from a store. So you don't have to do the application yourself. Again, since those have already been embedded and the, you know, the chemical has dried, it's attached to the fibers. It's not going to come off onto your animal or yourself as you touch it. It's really only going to repel or kill those insects if they come into contact with it.
Someone else wonders which counties report the highest number of Lyme disease cases.
Yeah, so we do see the most number of cases in the northern part of the state, typically the northwestern part of the state. But this has really changed over the last few years in that we used to only see Lyme disease cases in the northern part of the state. And those of us that lived in the southern part of Wisconsin or the southeastern part of the state really didn't have to worry unless we traveled to that, you know, the northern parts of the state. So over the last few decades, the deer tick has expanded into other parts of the state, including southern Wisconsin. So now we see deer ticks in every single county in Wisconsin, unfortunately. There's still a gradient. We still see the most number of ticks and the most number of Lyme disease cases in the northern regions of Wisconsin. There's just great tick habitat up there. These deer ticks love lots of wooded areas, lots of leaf litter. It's perfect habitat for them. So this is still highest risk in Wisconsin, but unfortunately there is a risk essentially in all counties in the state. Of course, if you're in a very urban location, you're likely a little bit safer, but there can still be ticks that people pick up in urban parks and even urban yards where there's wooded areas. So keep that in mind as you're moving around outdoors.
Yeah, I think there were, in 2022, there were 264 cases in Dane County and quite a large number in Waukesha as well. So You got to be vigilant. And Rebecca, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for taking time. Boy, it flew by. I hope we can have you back. Thank you.
Of course. Thank you.
Rebecca Osborne, epidemiologist specializing in vector-borne diseases with our Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Big thanks to her. And a big thanks to you for listening in. This and all our shows are a team effort. For this show, our producers are Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod. Technical directors are Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. And our executive director is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store here on WPR News.